by Granard Center for the Performing Arts, a home for contemporary theatrical events in March and April. City Company teams up with musical ensemble Rachel's in Systems Layers. British and American companies Modi Rodi and the Builders Association present Aladdin. And the U of I Department of Theater offers Marisol and Aloha Say the Pretty Girls. For more information or tickets, visit GranardCenter.com. Today's programming is made possible in part by the Beckman Institute for Advanced Science and Technology Open House, Friday, March 11th and Saturday, March 12th on the U of I campus. Exhibits include disco balls that make people disappear and flight simulators a child can use. The Beckman Cafe will also be open for meals, snacks, and beverages. More information is available at www.beckman.uiuc.edu.
Good morning and welcome back to the second hour of Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for the show, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, and at the controls this morning is Jason Croft. Well, in this part of Focus 580, we will return to a subject that we have discussed before, and I expect this is not the last time, and the topic is Social Security. President Bush has said that here in this second term, he intends to make Social Security and changes to Social Security one of his top domestic issues. He has for some months now been saying that the system is in crisis, although I think recently he's backed off a little bit on using the word crisis. But nonetheless, he's made the argument that if nothing is done to change the way Social Security is organized, that when today's young workers get ready to retire, the system will essentially be bankrupt. And the money won't be there to pay their benefits. And he has made a number of proposals. However, other people in Washington, D.C. aren't so sure. Public opinion surveys show that Americans understand that there is a problem, and yet they don't seem to share this sense of crisis and have expressed some skepticism about some of the proposals the president has made, particularly his proposals about giving people the opportunity to set up private accounts. Well, we will take up the issue once again this morning with our guest, William Spriggs. He is now a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. Before that, he served as executive director of the National Urban League Institute for Opportunity and Equality, and he's had a long career both in academe and government. He served as senior advisor to the Associate Deputy Administrator for Government Contracting. He also worked in the Small Business Administration, was special advisor in the Office of the Undersecretary for Economic Affairs at the Commerce Department. And before going to Capitol Hill, he was involved in the Clinton administration. He was the leader of the staff of the National Commission for Employment Policy. He's also taught at the university level. He taught in the School of Business at Norfolk State University in Virginia. We also directed the university's honors program. Also for 2 years at the School of Business at North Carolina A&T State University in Greensboro. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions certainly are welcome, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. He was, by the way, here on the campus of the University of Illinois just a couple of weeks ago, taking part in a forum on Social Security sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study. So perhaps some people who will be listening to us this morning in Champaign-Urbana might have had the opportunity to attend the forum. We couldn't talk with him while he was here, but we did want to have him on the program, so we're pleased that he could be with us. Dr. Spriggs, hello.
Thank you for having me this morning.
Well, we certainly appreciate you giving us your time. I wonder if at the beginning we might talk a little bit about, and you can share your perspective there being in Washington, mm-hmm. about where things stand now in the discussion about Social Security, since as everything I read says a couple of things. It says that the president is continuing to make the arguments that he has made, that on Capitol Hill, it seems that a lot of Democrats and even some Republicans aren't quite sure what the nature of the problem. Well, maybe they know what the nature of the problem is, but they're not quite sure what to do about it. And then if you look at public opinion, it says that, yeah, people get it. They understand the idea that we're going to get to this point where there'll be more money coming out than going in. But again, there seems to be a little bit of ambivalence about, well, what do we do about this thing? And not a whole lot of support for private accounts. Where in politically speaking, where does this debate stand right now?
It appears frozen. The Washington Post reported this morning that they conducted a poll, which I guess was to verify for themselves many people know that the Democratic whip had been reporting for some time on the Senate side that the president wasn't going to get any support, and 41 Democratic senators had sent him a letter saying so. But the Post confirmed through their own polling that there just aren't any votes in the Senate to make this happen, and that Democrats are going to continue to say that if the president wants private accounts, that's a non-starter for the discussion. And I think everyone understands that the private accounts aren't a solution, and the president hasn't put on the table what he thinks the actual solvency solution would be. So we're at a strange stalemate because the president has a proposal which has nothing to do with solvency, holding up getting to the discussion on what can we do about Social Security solvency. And so that's where we are.
Mm-hmm. I understand that there has been some talk about the fact that the administration, while they have not made this as a formal proposal, they have laid out this idea that one of the things that could be done would be to make a change in the way that the benefits are calculated. And that essentially would reduce the payout to beneficiaries in the future, and that would help with the solvency issue. Now, that apparently is out there, but I don't think the White House has in a sort of formal way said this is what we want to do. But it is out there, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct. The president had a commission to strengthen Social Security aimed at providing different solutions for how you would do privatization. And in that process, they came up with a plan which included a different way of calculating the initial benefit. One key way of looking at the problem, I think, as the president looks at the problem, is currently we treat the old age benefit, we treat all benefits within the system, because there's only one formula that determines benefits across the programs, whether you get disabled, whether you get survivor's benefits, or whether you get the old age benefit. Your family gets the same benefit based on your work history, and it is to allow you to replace your earnings. So essentially what that means is we are indexing the benefit as wages increase, and wages tend to increase as the economy increases. So the president, I think, is looking at the problem this way. You can never reduce the cost of such a program because you are letting workers replace their current income, and so each beneficiary will have their benefits go up as the economy grows. So if you have an increase in the number of beneficiaries, then the size of the program will grow. Hmm. And the idea of price indexing is to fix the growth of the program so that it cannot grow as quickly, and that makes the program smaller. And I think the way to think of this is as follows. Because we index to wages, it means that beneficiaries are allowed to consume pretty much as their size of the population grows. That's how we've currently geared it. And at some point, a higher share of the population will be 65 or older. They're the predominant sort of age group. They'll be 62 or older. That's the predominant age group. And so you're going to have a bigger program because they're going to be a bigger share of the economy. And that would mean they would consume more. That's what it would mean. So it sort of follows that a bigger share of everything we produce would end up going to them unless you cut their income. And that's really where the debate is, because the price indexation means that we're going to cut their consumption. We're not going to let them be the same percentage of the population as they are going to be of consumers. Hmm. That's sort of in a nutshell what the issue is.
As you have said, it seems politically there's a stalemate. Mm-hmm. Now, as people have looked at the solvency question, they have said, well, there are some number of things that could be done, mm-hmm. individual nation. We could, for example, this what the White House has talked about, well, that's one thing you could do. You could raise taxes and you could raise the age at which people could receive benefits. You could Because right now, the amount of income that is taxed for Social Security purposes essentially is capped. So you could say, well, okay, we're going to raise that, and or some combinations of these things could be done. Is there any in Washington? Do you think is there even any kind of consensus on among the sorts of things that people have said, well, we could do this, we could do this, we could do a combination of these things, any sort of a consensus that might lead to a potential plan, and anything that people could really sit down at the table and say, okay, here's some concrete ideas, let's talk about this and see what we could do with this.
Well, that's where things fall apart again, because as you mentioned, a potential thing would be to raise the cap. Currently, for this year, income $90,000 and below gets taxed, but above $90,000 does not get taxed. When the Greenspan Commission put forward the current financing plan in 1983, what no one could foresee was the rapid growth and inequality and a bigger and bigger share of income going to those at the top. So we have a very quickly growing amount of earnings that go untaxed. Somewhere on the order of $300 billion has now grown to on the order of $700 billion in a very short amount of time. And the conservative Republicans, those who belong to the Republican Study Committee caucus on the Hill, are adamant that they will not entertain any proposal that would raise the cap. The gap in financing that we're looking at, so people can understand what we're really arguing about, if you believe the Social Security actuaries, instead of people paying 6.2%, if we did this with nothing but taxes, then they'd have to pay 7.15% if you believe the trustees. If you believe the Congressional Budget Office, instead of paying 6.2%, people would have to pay 6.7%. That's the size of the problem. And so when you hear it that way, you know, do I pay 6.2 or 7.15, or do I pay 6.2 or 6.7, you know, depending upon the forecast? It sounds very small, but the study committee and conservative Republicans are adamant they're not for raising taxes either from the 6.2 to 6.7 or of saying to those who make $90,000 and above, look, over the last couple of years, all of the income growth has been towards the 6% of the population that makes that amount of money. And we've given you a big tax break because the effective tax rate for those above $90,000, their effective Social Security tax rate, has been declining rapidly. And we don't want to restore any equilibrium about the effective tax rate for those people. So we're at a stalemate. You can't get enough votes from Republicans if you say you're going to enhance revenue. Democrats have said nothing so far about what they would accept or reject within solvency. What they have said they would reject is private accounts, because that really totally changes the nature of Social Security. You cannot put Social Security back together once you put private accounts in. And again, it's because currently the program is an integrated program. Retirement is not a separate program. Retirement is a benefit among disability and survivors, and under the current system, which is an insurance system, that's the same benefit.
Let me ask you one further question, and I have a couple of callers here. I want to tell them, I won't make them wait forever. We'll get right to them. Given the fact now that the Republicans and Democrats have both staked out some territory, mm-hmm. and that they are looking forward to midterm elections. That's not that long from now, and certainly would not want to do anything to alienate their constituents and potential voters. I wonder what you think the chances are that anything will happen on this issue before the midterm elections, and then one has to wonder even past that point. That is, maybe I shouldn't say anything, but anything in the way of a major change?
I would find it difficult to have the major change of private accounts happen politically, because I don't think Democrats are going to back down from that. So will the president be willing to give that up and start the serious negotiations around solvency? And I don't know, because the real holdup in the solvency debate is the position that conservative Republicans have taken, that there's no way they will agree to increase revenues, which means that it would all have to be through benefit cuts in some form. And I don't think anyone wants to run on that next year. Mm-hmm. And so unless the mood of the country changes about the nature of the crisis, then I don't think that that's sellable. I don't think people are willing to accept that. If you're talking about paying 6.2% or 6.7%, and you tell people, well, we're not agreeing to that, or we're not agreeing to restoring the effective tax rate for those above $90,000, the only way we can do this is through benefit cuts, I don't think people are going to accept that as bargaining.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Dr. William Spriggs. He is senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C., and has had positions in higher education, in government. He's former executive director of the National Urban League Institute for Opportunity and Equality, has had jobs in the Small Business Administration, the Department of Congress. In the Clinton administration, he led the staff of the National Commission for Employment Policy. He's also taught at Norfolk State University in Virginia and North Carolina A&T State in Greensboro. He's joining us this morning by telephone. We're talking about Social Security. We have several callers here who are interested in joining the conversation. We just ask people to be brief, and we just ask that so that we can keep the program moving. But, of course, anyone listening is welcome to call 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana. Toll free 800-222-9455. Our first caller is someone listening in Indiana on our line number 4, toll free line. Hello.
Yeah, hello. Mm-hmm. An anecdote and one question. Mm-hmm. When this first hit the table in terms of basically being in the larger newspapers and on public radio, when I found out that the tax was only going up to $90,000 and everything above that wasn't taxed, I thought, that's extremely unfair. So I think that's the best way to go at it. That allows people still to retire at 62 if they want to, or whenever, up to the, you know, the mandatory question. Two countries, Chile and Britain, have this private, I call it donation to the rich, but anyway, they have the privatization. I don't know what percentage it is. I don't know any material things about, you know, how much you're allowed to put in and things like that. But I do know that the main criticism of it is that the administrative costs usually wipe out whatever rise you might have in stocks. Thanks a lot.
All right. Well, is that something that you can talk about?
Yes, and it's true the way that they did it in Chile and in the UK brought about huge problems, because they did it the way that a lot of people have it described to them. That is, that you can invest in whatever you wanted to invest in, and it's your money, and you will make wiser choices than the government. The administration has learned from that, and they are not going to allow that. So what the administration is proposing in its private accounts is essentially a stock index fund. That would be one choice, which is the most risky. And then they are strongly encouraging people to get their life cycle fund, which would put you heavily in stocks when you're young, but as you got older, the portfolio would switch you into bond funds. So as you got closer to retirement, you wouldn't be as susceptible to market fluctuations. But that means that the administrative costs of the program from the government's perspective are going to go up tremendously, because currently the program has minuscule administrative cost, less than 1%. And so the administrative costs from the government perspective are going to skyrocket. The government will have to establish an agency to handle the smaller accounts, because we're not putting that on the fund managers. That will be on the government side. And the money in these accounts, the money in the Social Security system isn't kept in real time by individuals, and that's why you have to increase the bookkeeping on the government side, and you're going to increase the government administrative cost tremendously. But the fees that the Wall Street firms will charge will be extremely limited, because really there isn't anything for them to do.
I think, in fact, that some people have made this argument in response to those people who say that if these accounts were put into place, it would be a windfall for people in the investment business, because they would get to administer the accounts, and there would be a lot of them, and they would have the opportunity to make money. I think some people have said, well, in fact, that it wouldn't, that would not be the case, that we might have a lot of accounts, but they wouldn't be very big accounts, and that in fact Wall Street wouldn't realize a big windfall, that they might even say it'd be more trouble for them almost than it would be worth. Is, I don't know if that's too extreme, or actually there's something to that.
Well, it is a huge windfall to Wall Street in two ways. One, Goldman Sachs estimates that this fund would end up being roughly equal to 25% of the market. And with the government paying for all the management fees in terms of the, you know, actually holding the money, collecting the money, worrying about where the money is, with the government doing that and these funds being limited to index funds, they could run by autopilot. So even if Wall Street only charged, 4 basis points, this is a lot of money, given that they don't have to do anything to earn it. So it is a windfall, and at some point, of course, if the Goldman Sachs economists are correct and the size of the fund is what it is, it will have a lot to do with what the price of stocks are. So anyone who is in a longer term relationship with the market and has stocks before this fund builds up is going to gain, because the demand is going to drive the price up. So it will be a windfall for those currently in the market ahead of the curve, and these fees are going to be collected essentially for doing nothing. And so that's a windfall to me.
All right, let's go talk. We'll talk next with another listener. This is someone in Champaign, and line one. Hello.
Yeah, I sense something interesting about this whole problem, in that I don't sense that Bush actually wants to solve the problem of Social Security. What I mean by that is, since 1978, he's been very much into this notion of private accounts, and I sense a kind of ideological drivenness in this, insofar as, or impudence, I suppose, insofar as, you know, the White House itself has said this does not help with solvency. The White House own actuary on the Hill a few days ago admitted that it would actually cost money, you know, a lot of money to administrate this, and that he actually, you know, the senators were saying that this would eat up apparently 4% of the entirety of Social Security to do this, which would cost another 11 years of shortening of, you know, the time between now and the so-called bankruptcy. So 2032 would be the problematic year at that point. And so what I don't understand is he's going on this large tour claiming he's going to try to solve Social Security, but the whole tour, and this is open, you know, news, that he wants to, you know, show that the private accounts are a great thing as, quote-unquote, a way to deal with Social Security. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. And so I'm flabbergasted, and I hope that the press will make the point of the, you know, fundamental incongruence of his position on this. He's not trying to solve the problem of Social Security, even according to the White House, insofar as he just talked about private accounts. And so that's a problem. And also, you know, when one thinks about the national debt, I mean, here's a man who's done nothing. I think we have the greatest national debt in history now? At least second to Reagan, I suppose. So it's phenomenal, because I don't know what you think, but I can't imagine that this isn't the more urgent problem is the national debt rather than Social Security. And another thing I just want to ask finally is, Paul Krugman has said that you would have to get a return of about 7% really to make money on these private accounts, even if they do, you know, use Bush's plan. And he said it would be equivalent to the height of the 90s stock boom. It would have to stay at that level for the duration of your life, basically, for you really to get your money back in this. And so I'm curious whether you think that's accurate, whether that's a bit of an exaggeration. I'm just curious, but I'd like to get your take on that.
Well, in order for the plan to do what the president would like it to do, you do need something on the order of a 6%, 7% rate of return from the market. And that is because, again, he doesn't want the program to grow. The program will grow because the share of those over 65 is growing. And that means if you don't want those over 65 to continue to consume what would be, some people would say, their fair share. You know, if you're 12% of the population, you're going to consume about 12% of the GDP. So at some point, a disproportionate share of GDP are going to go to those over 62, just because they're going to be a bigger share. Now, how do you fund that? Now, you could do it by saying the way we currently do it. You just tax workers, and that's how we do it. Or you say, as the president is proposing, we won't do that. Instead of taxing workers out of the growth and productivity, we're going to use productivity growth through the stock market, and workers will get it out of the way that productivity growth will evidence itself in the stock market. Either way, you're still going to end up with 12% of GDP or whatever percent, 6% is really what the program would be, 6% of GDP going to, and so that becomes a bet.
Well, do you bet
the market will do that or not? And most people don't want to take that bet. He has created, as you say, a huge problem because in the short run, the cash flow problem of the Social Security program is that from general revenue, we have to pay back the Treasury notes that are currently held by the Social Security Trust Fund. That has to come out of general revenue. And the budget that he has proposed increases the federal debt, the deficit as well as the debt. Mm-hmm. And so when that day comes in 2019 or whenever, he has not created a income flow for the government to pay the trust fund. We will continue to borrow from the general population as well as the world to do that. So he has not put in place a reasonable stream of government revenue because of his tax cuts.
Yeah, I mean, something that surprised me was that, if I understand, even in the popular press, which I don't watch much, but I even noted there that they were noting that the White House admitted that this does not help with solvency, this in terms of solvency of Social Security, the private account. So it just doesn't make any sense to me that he's going around on this tour if they've admitted that it doesn't actually solve that problem.
Well, and it's not resounding with people precisely because of the point you're making. It doesn't solve solvency. It has nothing to do with solvency. It really has to do with the philosophical question of how will we handle a higher share of people being above 62 and letting them consume their fair share of GDP. That's a philosophical question, and I think most people are answering in the polls. That's not something they want to gamble with. They think that you should do that with some certainty. And again, because the tax gap is small, again, if you believe the CBO projections, we're talking about 6.2 versus 6.7% in payroll tax. We're talking a small gap. People don't get that's such a crisis that you have to throw the baby out with the bathwater.
Right. Well, as you know, of course, there was this famous internal memo among the top Republicans. I'm not sure which group it was exactly, but saying that this was the biggest chance in 60 years for the right wing. So I think philosophical or ideological, whichever way you put it, I think that has a lot to do with their efforts in this regard.
Okay. I think when you analyze it fully, that's correct, that this is really a philosophical question about whether we want to continue with the belief that we are all in it together, that we are truly insuring ourselves as Americans, or whether we want to cast that aside and say that we're not going to do that anymore. And I do think that's what's driving this, and that's why the lines are driven, the lines in the sand are so deep.
We are talking this morning with Dr. William Spriggs. He is a senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. He's former executive director of the National Urban League Institute for Opportunity and Equality. He has had a number of posts in the government. He worked in the Small Business Administration and also the Department of Commerce. During the Clinton administration, he led the staff of the National Commission for Employment Policy. He's also taught in the schools of business at Norfolk State University, that's in Virginia, and North Carolina A&T State in Greensboro. He's former president of the National Economics Association, which is the organization of professional black economists. He also serves on the Black Enterprise Magazine Board of Economists. And it was here in Champaign-Urbana not very long ago, back in February. He was one of the panelists as part of a forum looking at the issue of Social Security, sponsored by the Center for Advanced Study on the U of I campus. Questions are welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk with someone in Aurora. This is caller on line number two. Hello.
Yeah, I had a few questions. When an immigrant gets Social Security, don't they have to have the 20 quarters to get it? And I feel that the stock market will get the greatest benefit from this. And I wondered who was working with him in Washington on this. And how high, is there a cap on if you have too high an income, you don't get Social Security?
Well, let me answer that question. everyone who meets the criteria would get a Social Security benefit. You can get the benefit because you become disabled and are no longer able to work. That's determined at a state-level hearing, and it's not the easiest thing in the world to get, but that is available to American workers. You get it if you're a family member of a worker who dies. 98% of American children are eligible to get Social Security benefits in the event of a parent becoming disabled or dying, and you get the retirement benefit if you reach age 62. You can take early retirement, or if you reach age 65 currently, and it will increase for those in the baby boom up to age 67. So everyone would get it who meets just those requirements. So even if you're Bill Gates, you would get a Social Security check, but it does reach a maximum, and that's part of the logic behind the cap and the tax on earnings, because the benefit does not rise forever. The benefit replaces a high share of earnings for low-income workers and then a decreasing share of earnings for other workers, so that Bill Gates eventually reaches a maximum amount, which would be close to the replacement rate for somebody at $90,000 a year. So despite the fact that he makes millions of dollars a year, he will get a benefit roughly equal to the same of someone who would make $90,000 a year. And that's the reason for the cap and the tax. Immigrants can get Social Security, but they have to have the same 40 quarters of earnings as anyone else. So they would essentially have to have worked for 10 years to be eligible. Their benefit would be based on their work history, as is the case for all workers. And so in that sense, and this is the difficulty in creating a private account, the president doesn't have an easy way of maintaining equity. Every worker with the same work history gets the same benefit. Their family gets the same benefit. This is a family program. The there is a primary insurance amount that determines your benefit, but immediately tied to your primary insurance amount is the family maximum benefit. Anyone who is dependent on you being in the workplace gets a benefit to recognize that the reason why Americans go to work is to support either their spouse or to support their spouse and their children. And so it's to prevent economic destitution because you lose the ability to work. So when you introduce a private account and you start talking about retirement and everything that's been mentioned about the private accounts talks about a long time to make a long to compound your gains, and so by the time you're 65, you have this pot of money, which could compensate someone drawing on the old age benefit. But people who become disabled or people who die unexpectedly, of course, don't have that long time horizon, and that means you can't quite piece together the equity that is in the system today. And you can get all sorts of anomalies. You can get someone, for instance, if today a man at age 58 had a massive stroke and couldn't work and took disability, when that man reached age 65, the family would start getting the retirement benefit. They wouldn't notice anything at all because his work history is set, his benefit level is set, and so no one would know in the family that they're now actually considered a retired worker, even though he initially went in as a disabled worker. Nothing would be different. Under a private account, then you have to say, well, what happens when he reaches 65? Now you're going to give him retirement benefits, but he hasn't worked for 7 years. His personal account is going to be smaller. If you take the fiscal neutral position that the administration has, he has a reduced guaranteed benefit, and the private account is supposed to make up part of that. Well, he's not going to make it up fully, and his benefit is going to get cut. So, you know, what does it mean if the president says he's going to hold the disabled harmless? They're not really being held harmless. If you say, on the other hand, oh, okay, I let him keep the higher benefit, then suddenly the disabled are being treated different than retirees, and so the guy who's 58 and becomes disabled is better off than the guy who is healthy with the same work history, and that doesn't seem equal. What happens if you say, well, neither one, I'll just have sympathy for survivors. So suppose he had the stroke at 58 and he ends up back at the hospital because of complications at 61. Is he going to be worth more to his widow if he dies than if he lives? You get weird anomalies like that because you're separating out what is currently an integrated program. And you would treat people differently. And currently the system treats people equally. And that's why, for instance, when the president says African-Americans don't get treated fairly, that's just patently false. Because the program treats disabled survivors and old-age beneficiaries exactly the same. The family would get the same benefit no matter what happened to that 58-year-old.
Thank you.
All right, thanks for the call. I wanted to ask a question. You just touched on it just in the last couple of seconds.
Mm-hmm.
About African Americans and Social Security, because the president he's been talking about his ideas about Social Security a lot and has been traveling around the country talking to various kinds of groups, and he has made, I think, a particular kind of appeal to African Americans, saying that he feels that the system as it is designed now, that under that system, African Americans get a bad deal, and that they, as a group, should be behind his plan to change the system, because he feels that in that way that system will be modified, and they will benefit more than if nothing is changed at all. And I guess I do have that fundamental question. I say, when he says that African Americans get a bad deal under the system as it exists now, is that, do you think that is the case?
It's absolutely not the case. Clearly, African Americans do not benefit as much from retirement benefits. He has the fact correct that African American men, in particular, have a lower life expectancy. So he's absolutely right that it's far less likely than for whites that African Americans withdraw the retirement benefit. But because the program is an integrated program and disability, survivor, and old age are treated equally by the system, that means that if you don't make it to retirement, then the question is, well, how does the system treat you? And since it treats you the same whether you become disabled or are a survivor, that's why African Americans under the current program get treated fairly. Senator Obama was on a panel with me yesterday, and I think he put it really in a wonderful way. Social Security is an insurance program. The title is Old Age Survivors and Disability Insurance. The benefit is called the primary insurance amount. The tax you pay to support it is called the Federal Insurance Contribution Act tax. The word insurance appears everywhere. Retirement never appears in the name of the program. So what Senator Obama pointed out was that would be like saying, since black homes are worth less than white homes, on average, we know the median value of homes for blacks is less, then blacks shouldn't buy fire insurance because you're going to get a smaller benefit if your house burns down. So you should self-insure because your homes are worth less. And, of course, you know, you sort of listen to them, you go, what? It doesn't make sense. And that's really what the president is saying, and for that same reason, it doesn't make sense that that African Americans are shortchanged. We're all buying the same policy, and we all get the same coverage. Now, if you privatize, then you create a lot of inequities that start to work to the disadvantage of African Americans on the retirement side. And just to go through it quickly. Because of the cap, and African Americans make less than whites, fewer African Americans are above that $90,000 a year group. And because of that, a disproportionate share of the revenue into the program is paid by African Americans. It is a regressively funded program. The program makes up for that because it's a progressive benefit, so that those with lower income get a higher replacement rate. The private account is purely regressive because it depends solely on what you made. So you're replacing a progressive benefit with a regressive benefit on top of the regressive tax. So private accounts make it doubly unfair to African Americans. And then the private accounts accentuate all of the racial disparities in the labor market that the Social Security benefit formula work against. African Americans are far more likely to be unemployed, particularly when they are young. The Social Security Administration formula says we take your 35 highest years of earnings. So essentially in the early 20s, when African Americans have a hard time getting attached to the labor market, get excused under the current formula. African Americans have to get more education than whites to make the same amount of money. An African American needs some college to make the same amount of money as whites do with simply a high school education. So some years in the early part of one's career have to be spent getting that extra education on the part of African Americans just to get the same pay as whites. And that's time out of the labor force when you are young. And I bring up those two issues about what happens when you're young because you get more from savings that accumulate over a number of years than you would when you're older. So the money that's put aside in your account when you're 20 creates a bigger disparity than the money that's put aside when you're 40 because it has a longer time to compound. And then the other problem is a labor market, stock market confluence. African Americans, because of our higher unemployment rate, are far more sensitive to economic changes. And so when the stock market is doing real well, it's because the economy is doing real well. And that means in African-American private accounts, you're going to have blacks tending to get more money put aside buying stocks when they're high. And then when the market goes down, that's because unemployment has gone through the ceiling because the economy has slowed down. And so blacks are not accumulating lots of stocks when the market is down. So that will make the rate of return even lower for African Americans. So you add up all the things that the private accounts would do, and there's absolutely no way that private accounts make things fairer. And, of course, private accounts don't solve the problem of life expectancy.
Mm-hmm.
It's still going to be the case that African Americans don't make it to retirement, whether you have a private account or not.
Yeah.
So nothing in the private accounts makes any sense in the argument. And it really is, as Senator Obama said, it's like telling somebody, your house is worth less, so don't buy fire insurance, just self-insure it.
Okay. Well, we have several callers waiting. We'll try to get in as many as we can. The next in line is in Urbana on our line number 3. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Oh, I really do. I'm enjoying this, your discussion very much. And I would want you to discuss just a little bit a question that I have. And it involves, you were talking about how the program would grow. And it doesn't ever get smaller. But to my way of thinking, the number of retired baby boomers will be climbing now for, I don't know, what is it going to be, 10 years and peak out maybe and then start to decline, won't it? So that there's a relationship between the growth of the program and the number of people who are going to retire. But then eventually those retired baby boomers are going to start to die out and then the program would begin to shrink up a little bit. Is that relationship true or not?
Well, what's about to happen is that the program will stabilize because the share of the population that will be older is going to reach a stable level. And the real question isn't the two workers to one retiree, because that's comparing apples to oranges. Workers today are far more productive than workers in the past. And, you know, it's easy to understand why.
Mm-hmm.
They had telephones and typewriters and paper Rolodexes, and people today work with
mm-hmm.
the Internet and have BlackBerry. So
mm-hmm.
so it's easy to understand that. And so what happens in the future is we will have to take care of more as a share of the population, but that will stabilize, and as productivity increases, the burden that places on a worker actually will continue to decline. So after the baby boomers retire, the burden of future retirees, even though it would be two workers to one retiree, looks very different because those workers will be that much more productive. Their lifestyles are going to be so much better
mm-hmm.
that and this is not a big program, and the increase that we're talking about, going from 4% to 6% of GDP, is not a big deal when you think of the massive increases we have had in defense spending over time or the growth in other federal expenditures over time. So this does stabilize, and it does stabilize with respect to the size of the economy and actually starts to get smaller as people become more productive. And yes, it will look smaller again, and from that perspective of what do we have available to pay the benefits.
Well, my understanding, too, is that this crop of baby boomers is really a huge bunch of people relative to the following group. And so it seems to me that when they actually get old enough and begin to die out, that you know, the burden on the workers that are following even further behind there, it's going to get, you know, even a lighter share. But, you know, it's hard to guess what's going to happen in 20, 30 years, but that's what it seems like to me. So, anyway, thank you.
All right, well, thanks for the call. Let's go next to someone else here. Line 4, someone here in Champaign-Urbana. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Interesting. Could you comment, por favor, on the cost of living, COLA allowance? Could it, in theory, ever be reduced? That is, if average wages drop and so forth. But a second question then, the Concord Coalition and others, they make projections, as you mentioned so well recently, that it should take into account productivity as well as the number of workers. But has anyone factored in fact that a lot of high-paying jobs are going overseas? So comment on those. Yeah. Gracias.
And I'm afraid, Dr. Spriggs, we're getting short on time. I know there's a big question, so I can really only give you about a minute to make some kind of response.
The growth of wages and the growth in wage inequality are the things that we have been very bad in forecasting, even in the short run. And that is a key reason why we should not think that we can solve this problem for 75 years. We should think about shorter time horizons and be quite prepared, as we have over the last 50 years, to make changes as, you know, the numbers come in and we see what the future really does look like.
Hmm. Well, my apologies to a couple of callers that we have left because we're not going to be able to take them. We have used our time. However, I am certain that we will, in the weeks and months to come, be talking about the same subject with other guests. We'll continue to follow the conversation, so you can rely on that. We'll keep talking about it. I also want to say thanks to our guest, Dr. William Spriggs. He is a senior fellow. He's an economist and senior fellow at the Economic Policy Institute in Washington, D.C. And Dr. Spriggs, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Oh, thank you. I enjoyed it.
The broadcast today is made possible with support from the Great Impasta, a restaurant serving foods from northern Italy. The Great Impasta is at 114 West Church in Champaign, and the staff there at the Impasta encourage you to join them in supporting AM 580. The broadcast is also made possible with support from Warden Martin Subaru, a Subaru Stellar Performer certified dealership, now in their new location in front of the Savoy 16 Theater across from Warden Martin Nissan. Information is available on the web at wardenmartin.subaru.com. And that is it for us here on Focus 580. Of course, we hope that you will stay tuned because programming here will continue. There'll be news and sports and weather and other things and another interview, another conversation coming along, all as part of the afternoon magazine with Celeste Quinn, which starts right now.
Thank you, David. Good morning. Coming up today in the 1 o'clock hour of the afternoon magazine, we'll talk with writer Emily Rabiteau. Her short fiction has been awarded the Pushcart Prize and the Chicago Tribune's Nelson Algren Award. Her latest fiction is her debut novel, The Professor's Daughter. The novel is an exploration of race, assimilation, identity, and family. We'll talk with Emily Rabiteau following the 1 o'clock news this afternoon. Let's take a look now at what's happening on the Board of Trade and the Mercantile Exchange. Prices are higher on the board. March wheat, $3.49.5, up $9.5. July, $3.62.5, up $7.5. March corn, $2.14.75, up $2.25. May, $2.22.75, up $2.75. July, $2.29.75, up $2.75. And December corn, $2.44.25, up $2.75. March beans, $6.52, that's up 18.75. May, $6.57.5, up 18.25. November, $6.32.5, up 8. March meal, $193.10, up $8.